So we obviously have our speaker. We're just waiting for someone to, for my colleague to log in so that we can access the slides. So he is almost here, I'm told. You'll be happy to know that the slides are in fact all preloaded. We just need that login. It's all just there. Ladies and gentlemen, a welcome finally to today's lecture. My name's Jonathan Curtis. I'm the Assistant Secretary of the Research Branch here in the Parliamentary Library. A very warm welcome to you all. This morning's lecture is, of course, what is happening in the US election, why and how it matters for Australia, and I'm delighted to welcome Professor Simon Jackman. I'll keep my introduction very brief, obviously. But other than to say, for those of us who work in Parliament and have an interest in elections, I think a US election is always going to be interesting, but I've never seen one quite as interesting or unusual as this one. So I very much look forward to hearing Professor Jackman's take on what's going on inside the election, what the polls and other predictive devices indicate will happen, and comparing some of those predictions against what actually happened against similar predictions with the campaigns in 2008 and 2012. Simon is, of course, CEO of the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney and comes to us with a great deal of experience in this particular specialisation. He researches public opinion, election campaigns, political participation, electoral systems, and with of course, special emphasis on the American political system. In the usual way of these things, our speaker will speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have time for some questions. So please join me in welcoming Professor Jackman.
Thanks for the kind introduction. My apologies for being late. I had an appointment elsewhere in the building downstairs that you don't control the timing of as much as you would like. It's a great pleasure as head of the Study Centre to be coming and talking to an audience like this. That's very much part of the job description at the Centre. Our mission is to provide analysis of the United States for Australians, and we're doing that for quite a few Australians, it would seem, today. Thank you for all coming out. It's an indication of the intense interest that this election, and for that matter, seems like every other US election tends to generate a tremendous amount of interest. 2008 was an incredibly exciting election as well. Let's get right into it. I'm going to show you how the race has evolved over the last 6 months, just with some what we call horse race polling. This is from a website called pollster.com. Which is part of the Huffington Post empire. I was their cut-rate version of Nate Silver in 2012, and those are my algorithms that take each dot as a poll result, and the trick is then fit a trajectory over time to that. And so you're relying not just on any single poll, but all the information that's across multiple polls, and leveraging the fact that some are close in time to one another as well to produce this, well, not especially smooth, but a reasonably smooth trajectory of voter support for either candidate over time. Here we were back in August 15 when We'd had one of these periodic blowouts in the margin, and this is coming on the back of the Democratic National Convention, where Clinton gets her convention bounce and Trump was out there railing against the Khan family. You might remember that military family. I know, it seems so long ago. But the margin had blown out to 8 points in not just in one poll, right, but across an average of polls. So there'd be some polls are saying plus 12, some would be saying plus one or two, but averaged across all the polls, at that point, we were up to an 8-point lead in the national polls. The other point to note is that at no point, going all the way back to the middle of last year, when people started to poll head-to-head for the presidency, Clinton versus Trump, at no point has Clinton ever not led Trump. It's always been fairly clear. It's gotten close at times, but at no point has Clinton ever fallen behind Trump. At no point did Barack Obama fall behind Mitt Romney in 2012, and only for 36 hours did Barack Obama fall behind John McCain, and that was the day that the Palin candidacy was announced, that first 36 hours, the two lines came together briefly. And I'll come back to that in a minute. September 20, Trump recovered a little bit because he sort of managed to say less, or what he said was a little more disciplined, and the gap had narrowed to about 4 points. But again, that's about as close as it's kind of ever been, particularly after each of them secured the nominations. There's Trump getting a little bit of a convention bump, and I guess it was pretty tight there. But then now... we're back, this was this morning, and it's back out to 7 points. And again, I want to stress that is not just one poll, that is an average of polls. Right? So it's not just you can find the occasional poll that says 7 or 8. You're finding the occasional poll that says 10, 11, 12, right? And the occasional poll that's saying 3, 4, and 5. But average across national polls, that's a 7-point lead. And if that holds up, or even if it were to fall back to 3 or 4 points, I think for all practical purposes, the presidential election is over. This is sort of my read of things. We will see. We are living in an unusual race, unusual times. Trump is not a usual candidate, and both he and Hillary Clinton are distinctive in the other thing that the polling reveals is the high levels of negativity associated, negative perceptions that people harbour to each candidate. For Hillary Clinton, the good news is there's someone less popular than her in American politics, and that's her opponent, Donald Trump. But they are the two least popular national figures at the moment. Hillary Clinton's negatives, as they're called, are in the mid-50s, and Trump's are in the high 50s. When you're in that environment of there being a lot of negativity or people are predisposed to think the worst should the worst come to be revealed. And I think that will be the story of this rather ugly election campaign that's yet to unfold, that we'll just see, I expect, another dump of documents from the Wiki people about Clinton and the Clinton Foundation, which will be immediately fire hosed off stage by, outrageous, ridiculous, disgusting even things from Trump's past, captured on videotape and whatnot. And we could see a sort of back and forth on that between now. But both campaigns, I think, so much of their campaigning strategy thus far and between now and the election is trying to exploit these great reservoirs of ill feeling that are held towards either candidate. The good news for Hillary Clinton, though, the flip side of that, is that the most popular national politician in the United States at the moment is the President of the United States, who will leave office probably with an approval rating in the high 50s, maybe even 60%. And he is campaigning for Secretary Clinton, as is his wife, the First Lady of the United States, who's an incredible campaigner, as it turns out, and delivers terrific stump speeches. And so those are two big weapons to have at your disposal when you're essentially seeking the third term, right, of the party that currently has the presidency has held it for two terms. As their candidate wants to seek a third term. The campaign star power that the incumbent president brings, who's sailing off into the sunset with all that good feeling and nostalgia, relatively speaking, is a great asset to have. So when you take these algorithms right now, the probability that Clinton wins, again, this is from various websites that I follow, the New York Times upshot model has the probability that Clinton wins the election is 89%. Nate Silver at 538 has three different models, a polls plus model, a polls only model, and something called a nowcast, and all of those are north of 80%. And Sam Wang, who is he's a Princeton faculty member, he's got a model very similar to the model I had at Huffington Post. His model's got it out at 97%. And basically what this is translating, I showed you, that's the national poll, but you can generate the national poll track, but you can generate one of these for each state. And it's important to remember the electoral system in the United States, right? It's winner-take-all by state. And then the winner of each state gets that state's allotment of electoral college votes, and whoever wins a majority of the electoral college is the president. So there are 538, and that's hence the name of Nate Silver's website, 538 electoral college votes, and majority plus one is 270, and that's the magic number. But with this very harsh winner-take-all rule, right? You win a state by one vote, right? 50.00001% of the vote, you get all of that state's electoral college votes. It's a harshly majoritarian system. And so small perturbations in the national vote, if that leads to a lot of seats flipping one side or the other, if they think of, to use an Australian metaphor, the pendulum swings a little bit nationally, that can often drag a lot of states one side or the other, and that can produce big changes rather quickly in the electoral college tally. And so that's why when you're out at leading seven nationally, state by state, that means you're ahead in many, many states, and hence the probability that you're at 270 or greater in the electoral college is getting way, way up there. That map's a little small, but I'll say just a little bit about it. That's impossible for you to see, but I've landed the green dot on the state of Ohio. No one has become president of the United States without winning the state of Ohio since John Kennedy did it in 1960. His running mate was Lyndon Johnson from Texas, and if you're not going to win Ohio, boy, it's helpful to win Texas, another big state with a lot of big in population, and hence with a lot of electoral college votes. No Republican has ever become president without winning Ohio. It's, I hate this metaphor, it's not quite the Eden Monaro of US politics, but, and Anthony Green's not in the room, I don't think, so I can get away with that. But it's an interesting state in the sense that it turns out its demographics are pretty finely balanced between groups that are predisposed to support Democrats and groups that are predisposed to support Republicans. Add to the fact it's got a lot of population and that electoral, and hence a lot of sway in that electoral college. Right? So a state that's finely balanced, but if you can tip it one way, you get a nice prize in electoral college votes. California, of course, is a big state, has the biggest state in terms of population, has a lot of electoral college votes, but it's not interesting politically. Well, it is interesting, it's just lopsided, is perhaps the better way to put it. And people really, you don't waste time there. You go there to fundraise in Hollywood and in Silicon Valley, and then you hop on the plane and you fly back to Ohio with the money and buy ads. And seriously, it's an ATM for the presidential, quite literally. Similarly, New York, a big population state, but incredibly Democratic. And as is, you know, Pennsylvania, a little more wobbly, New Jersey, Massachusetts. So some of these states with Michigan, Illinois, some of these states with large populations are just incredibly reliably Democratic. And so what that ends up meaning is that Hillary Clinton, and indeed any Democrat, comes into this election with just an enormously advantageous position electorally. To the extent where I was sort of, you know, and you'd never be tested on this, but almost any Democrat would beat almost any Republican, would be sort of the base model I would begin with, right? Don't tell me who the candidates are, but my presumption would be the Democrat will beat the Republican just because of the changing electoral geography in the United States, where there are just more and more of these states are blue, and in particular, this is very interesting, what's happening in this part of the country, the Mountain Time Zone. New Mexico, not a lot of people live there, but more people live in Colorado, and Colorado has become a blue state. Obama carried it twice, and it looks like Hillary Clinton will as well. Colorado, you know, I lived in the states for 25 years. When I first got to the United States, Colorado was a mining and ranching state, and now it's become, it is still that, and it's home to the Air Force Academy and some very conservative communities in various parts of the state, but that's been overwhelmed by the growth in service industries and knowledge-based industries in Denver and in Boulder and in the tourism industry. And over time, Colorado has gone from being a red state to a blue state, a Republican. And it's confusing for Australians. They use the color red for Republican. Elsewhere around the world, we understand red to be the color of the left, but it stuck. Apparently some intern at NBC News did this in the 1980s, and it stuck. But red means Republican, and blue means Democrat. Florida, you may remember, was the pivotal state in 2000. That's the state that went to court. Al Gore won the national vote, but lost the Electoral College vote after the Supreme Court shut down lawsuits that were challenging the outcome in Florida. That was the closest state in 2012, a state that we all managed to call correctly, but it was a very knife-edge thing. And for a while there, it looked like Donald Trump was going to do well in that state, but I think the events of the last week or so have kind of tilted that state and a lot of the other battleground states away from him as well. So right now, I mean, this map that Nate has, it had a Ohio-tinged kind of a pinkish red, as well as Florida, a pinkish red not so long ago. And that would have made this election a little more interesting. But the big story of American politics is that these states out here starting to go blue offset the historically important role that these big states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida, have played over the long haul. This was at one point shaping up as the cycle that would break the Ohio rule. And indeed, it's possible for Hillary Clinton, as I say, she has many ways to win without Ohio. That said, Trump doesn't. So for Clinton, it becomes if you stop Trump in any one of those, Ohio, Florida, or Pennsylvania, Trump effectively is blocked, cannot get to 270. Because being strong in all these states just doesn't add up. I mean, Texas is the single biggest Republican state in terms of electoral college votes, but averaging over the Dakotas and the states of the former Confederacy, some of the states of the former Confederacy through here, Nebraska, Wyoming, you're just not going. That's not how you get the 270, right? You've got to get some big prizes, and the thing that what offsets this, I mentioned the Mountain Time Zone. Nevada went for Obama twice. Arizona is now may come over. Everybody was wondering when demographic change would be sufficient to bring Arizona over, and this may be the cycle that does it with a kick along from Trump. And I'll say a little bit more about that demographic change in the next slide. The other thing to point out is that, again, over my time in the United States, Virginia started off, Virginia, may remember, is where not only was it a state of the former Confederacy, it was the capital, right? Richmond was the, right? It was the headquarters of the Confederacy. But as the federal government has grown in Washington, D.C., those northern suburbs of Virginia have become where knowledge workers and people live, college-educated people. It's racially integrated. It's huge and growing, reflecting the growth of the federal government, frankly, in the United States. And that has sung it kind of single-handedly, that and supporting industries, has powered a political transformation of the state of Virginia such that Obama won it twice as well. The idea, Virginia is a blue state, that was sort of just not something I think many people saw coming, say, when I first got to the United States in the late 80s, early 90s. But it is now, it's a very interesting state. I think it's made blue by what's going on right up there against Washington, D.C. Downstate is quite, in fact, you might even say extremely conservative. But there's just so much more population in the north of the state that makes it a reliably blue state. This is how we say Clinton has many ways to win, even if a state like Ohio were not to fall her way, but I think it will. And I think Trump's, the scandals of the last week or two, or I won't say weeks or years or decades, or the scandals, unbounded in their audacity and in time, I think have ended the matter effectively. It's hard to see with less than 4 weeks to go how you know we're looking at possibly the most lopsided result since 96, where Clinton beats Dole or Reagan beats Mondale. It could be out in that sort of territory. I want to say a little bit about the rise of Trump. How did we get to where we are? There's a lot of names for it. People were trying to put populism, it's anti-immigration, it's anti-globalization, economic nationalism or economic anxiety, but I think there's a much more simple explanation. And it's not a pretty one, but it's to do with race. And how race as a demographic fact, race as a way that cleaves Americans, race and ethnicity, but also how race structures the political attitudes of white people. Their beliefs about racial equality or the degree to which whites harbor racially prejudicial beliefs in turn predicts quite powerfully where they land politically. And I'll just give you a little bit of data on both of those. Americans under the age of 5 are majority-minority. Right? The majority-minority cohort is alive. Right? So by 2050, whites will no longer be a majority in America. So that generation is on its way. They are coming through the age distribution. This has been something in the works for a while, and indeed the state I lived in the most, California, is a majority-minority state, and has been for a while. But that's coming to all of America over time. Whites, non-whites, as a share of the electorate, used to be, back in the 80s, in about 85%. Right? The American electorate was about 85% white, and that slowly started to turn down and kind of accelerated perhaps a little bit. And the sawtooth pattern here around the trend down reflects the fact that minorities are less likely to vote in midterm elections. And in particular, right, in those Obama candidacies, Obama would mobilize minorities, driving the white share of the vote down. But then minorities would stay at home for the midterms, so the electorate was a little whiter in the midterms in 10 and in 14. And much of the story of this election, up until, I'd say, the last week, was about where this dot would land, where it will land for 16. And Trump's strategy is quite clear. He was trying to keep the blue dot high, right? White turnout is good for him. Minority turnout is bad for Trump, and conversely for Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. And the reason for that is that the white vote, which is a confronting phrase the first time you hear it, the white electorate. I remember, you know, I grew up in Australia, you go to the white electorate, and you go, okay. But the white electorate is a Republican electorate, right? Since 1964, whites have supported Republican candidates 60-40 or better. Right? That's just a fact about the party system in the United States. So I'll unpack this graph for us. This is from data from the American National Election Study. It's a survey that I was the director of for the 2012 and 2016 cycles, but it's been in business since 1952. And before and after each presidential election, we administer a very long survey. But at one point, since 1964, we've asked respondents the following question. We give them, you may have seen these thermometer rating scales. And you say, if you really don't like a person or a group, you know, you would score it a zero. If you really, really like a person or a group, you'd give that person or group a 100. And you can score that group somewhere on this 0 to 100 scale as you see fit. 50 would be so-so. And what I've done here, so you go to white people and you say, where do you put white people on that scale? It's a weird thing, right? And where do you put black people on that scale? Now, most people, when they're presented with that, most people, go 50-50. I'm not going to engage in an over expression of racial prejudice like that on a survey. The number 70, 61, 49, 51, that's the proportion of white respondents who rated whites higher than they rated blacks. Right, who engaged in a overt expression of prefer, thinking better of whites as a group than they think of blacks as a group. In 1964, 70% of whites on this survey gave whites a higher rating than they gave blacks. By the 2000s, the proportion of white respondents giving whites a higher rating than they gave blacks was down to the 30s and popped up to 36 in 2012. This is a face-to-face survey, by the way. This is not on the internet or on the phone. This is in front of a live interviewer engaging in this. And then what I did was break the white respondents into two groups. The red line are for the whites who express a preference or a higher thermometer score for whites over blacks. And the green line are whites who do not, who typically give both groups a 50-50 rating. And then we look at who they tell us they vote for. And in 1964, 70% of whites were in the red group. That is, they gave whites higher ratings than blacks. And they supported supported Lyndon Johnson over Barry Goldwater, 65-35 each. Lyndon Johnson promptly pivots the Democratic Party to become the party of civil rights and sets fire to the Democratic Party in the South. Right. And from that point on, at no point in American history since has either group gone, there's the 50% line, right? At no point since have whites as a group had majority support for a Democratic presidential candidate. And moreover, you can see at key moments, the gap in Democratic-Republican support across these two types of white people you can see who's more democratic. Well, it's the people with racially tolerant or have expressed racial equality in the way they've answered this question. They are more likely to support democratic candidates, and indeed that opened up quite considerably when Obama was the nominee. And that gap will be, I suspect, even larger once we get the 2016 data. But the point here is to say that It's race hardly entered the national political landscape in 2016. Right? It's been there, and indeed, you might even say further back in a more historical perspective, right? But in terms of modern electoral politics in the United States, race powerfully undergirds where white people land politically. That was true before Barack Obama. It's been true through Barack Obama, and will be true in this election where we've got a white woman running against a white man, and perhaps a. And indeed, I think it's especially true this time because the strategy of the white man has been to try and do something about this. In the face of declining market share, if you will, right, what can you do? Well, one is to smash the beehive, stir up, right, the white electorate. The problem is not that the white electorate is overwhelmingly Republican. The point is that not enough whites are voting. And how can I motivate whites to vote? Well, through a narrative of crisis and cultural decline and political correctness run amok, and by keeping the Bertha myth alive for 4 years, undermining the legitimacy of an African-American president. By saying that Mexicans, well, the things he said about Mexicans that I'm not going to repeat. But, right, so I think activating this long-standing predisposition, this leveraging off this architecture that's kind of baked into American public opinion, that's been part of Trump's strategy as an effort to deal with this issue. Right? There's a lot more white votes out there to get, or the issue is we need to even open up that gulf even more. That I've got to get more Republican votes out of this group. I think ultimately that's doomed as a strategy. I think it will fail now, not for that reason, but I think it will fail, frankly, because of these revelations about Trump's behaviour with respect to women, I think will be the nail in the coffin for Trump. But moreover, I think the demographic trend in the United States means that this is probably the last electoral cycle where that strategy could feasibly hope to be viable, as ugly and as distasteful as it has been. I think 16 is probably the last time you get to try that. 20, there'll be an incumbent running for re-election, maybe, and they typically tend to win. So if you think ahead to 2024, after another 8 years of demographic drift, that no one can do anything about, by the way, that's just a fact. That's kind of baked into the age distribution, the ethnic distribution of the United States, that's a demographic fact. The idea that you would then double down or triple down on racial animus among the white community to offset the fact that they constitute a smaller segment of the electorate, I think that's just, you know, A, extremely ugly, but B, probably just the math doesn't work going forward. And so I think there's some takeaways there. The Republican Party understands that they commission these postmortems after every election where must do better with minority outreach. Right? Mm-hmm. So Republicans have lost now 8 and 12, and they're probably going to lose 16, right? And they're sort of like, so we're doing really badly with minorities. And I'll finish by showing you just how badly they do with minorities. And I think the problem is generational turnover, and I think Trump will be an opportunity to clear house. If they were smart, this is what they'd do. I look to a set of leaders that are coming out of some of those mountain time zone states, who in some cases are Latino, right? So, for instance, there's a governor in Nevada, Governor Sandoval, Latino, Republican, successful governor, in a state that at the presidential level has gone for Obama, but he's won state elections, statewide elections there. He's about to become the president of the National Governors Association, which is a very powerful body in the United States and often a stepping stone to sort of doing something in the national, up at the national level. it's that generation of leaders. I think we're talking about almost a 20 to 25 sort of generational leap to make the Republican Party competitive in presidential elections. Time's out, so let me just skip through. They are deplorable. I like this. So political scientists measure racial prejudice in 18,000 different ways. This is yet another thing that in the literature is called racial resentment. And it, again, just to sort of underscore the point, as if you needed any more convincing on this, just how attitudes about race cleave across the Democratic-Republican divide. So this is this scale measure of racial resentment, and just this is where Trump people line up on that scale, and this is where Clinton people break up. And this was true. You could have done this 20 years ago and got a similar picture. It's just part of the architecture of American politics. I think what's interesting is that big spike there. People right at the very end of, hey, there's a lot of people there and expressing quite racially resentful is the word I'll use. So I'll finish with just two things. One is just to point out, I talked about the white electorate. The non-white electorate constituted 28% of the electorate in 2012 as non-white. Among whites, right, Obama lost to Romney like 60-40, but won the election pretty comfortably. And how does he do that? Because look at these margins for Obama in the remaining 28%. Blacks, 93-6. Hispanics, 71-27. Asians, 73-26. And that group's growing, and if you can turn them out, you can lose 60-40 among 72% of the electorate, but still win by 2 or 3 points nationally on the back of turnout here. That's the story of the American party system at the moment. And you can, again, just to come back, what is Trump trying to do? Either, yes, that's nice, but we'd like to win there 65-35. And by the way, if he did, he would win. Right? You can't, right? That is 72% is a big chunk of the electorate. And if Trump was able to do better than 59-39, something more like 65-35 or better, that would probably more than offset these gains. And question marks over how many of these groups are going to turn out for Hillary. The answer is they will, because Trump right, has alienated them so much, right? It's, you've always got to look at it from both sides. The gender story is a little complicated. And Hillary's candidacy, the prospect of becoming the first woman president of the United States, surely that's historic, and surely that's... This is before Trump, you know, was revealed to be, as outrageous, appalling as he is from last weekend's videotape and whatnot. The gender story did cleave by college degree. White women with a degree... Clinton was doing better than Obama did by 9 points. White women with no college degree, Clinton was actually doing worse than Obama did. I suspect that has now changed. Everything's, perhaps with the exception of that group, everything has gone in this direction. But the real story of the election and the tagline... This is from some analysis done back in August when things were a little tight. The real story was this, that Hillary was underperforming Obama by 14 points in this group here, white men with no degree. And it is no small exaggeration to say there just aren't enough of those people to be pivotal to tilt the election. They constitute a big chunk of the electorate, 20%. But Democratic advantage in these other groups will more than offset a pretty strong advantage that Trump will have in this group. Certain states, this demographic was, and that's why Florida was closed for a little while. and why Ohio was closed for a little while, but I don't think that's the case anymore because I think this is just all one-way traffic since the events of last weekend. And then finally, the last thing to say is the way the Republican Party has just run away from Trump since last weekend. Few have started to come back already, though. That's interesting, and I saw that overnight. But 30% of Republican senators disendorsed him. Virtually every Republican senator who's a woman walked away from Trump. Sandoval, one of those governors I was talking about, has walked away. And, you know, the party celebrities, Condi Rice, the Mitt Romney, the Bushes, Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, just have all said no. And the most key thing is that the Republican National Committee have essentially gone into save the furniture mode. That is, we will not be spending resources at the top of the ticket. We're out there to campaign to save our governorships, to save our senators, to save our House majority. And Trump was really relying on them for organization. Now, okay, this really is the last thing I'll say. In the American system, remember the importance of GOTV, get out the vote, right? It doesn't have compulsory voting. The parties essentially create these vast networks of on-the-ground field officers to coordinate literally good old-fashioned door-knocking mobilization at the grassroots. That is something that is very expensive to do, very time-consuming. You've got to be organized like mad. You just don't sort of click your fingers and make it happen in a weekend. In a big, big country like the United States, across 5 or 6, 7 really key states. Trump didn't do that, and Trump was really relying on the RNC for help on that. And when you look at it, this is the extent to which, you know, Obama and that campaign did this like no one else, and they just completely outclassed Romney on the ground in terms of getting out their vote. And there's Ohio, by the way, right? Right. And there's Ohio, right? And there's Florida, right? I mean, it's just, it's not rocket science, but deploying and managing those resources carefully is. That is a very scientific, very rigorous effort, but it's resource intensive and one that the Obama, powered by data and analytics kind of mindset as to how to engage in that resource allocation and resource management, came over essentially holus bolus to the Clinton, right, organization. What was 5 stories of Chicago office building is now like 8 stories of an office building in Brooklyn. Right. This is a business. This is a multi-hundred-million-dollar enterprise. And it's headquartered in Brooklyn for Clinton. But they that's what they do. They know how to turn out the vote, and it means having people on the ground and lots of them. And that's when you superimpose. And this is one reason, I think, why not only in the polls, but when it comes time to deliver people to the polls, if anything, could even be understating how strong Clinton is. The polls that I contributed to, that poll averaging exercise, we underestimated Obama's strength by about a percentage point, 1.5 points in the end, precisely because it was hard to factor in some of this stuff. Just the benefits from being so much better organized. Okay. So I think for myself, I'm sort of kind of happy to declare the presidential election over now. I really hope that's the case. I think that's good news for the world, frankly. I'm not going to shy away from that. I think it's good news for Australia. I think it makes people in the Australian government, makes people, the lay public, a little anxious when America hasn't got its act together, shall we say. And America hasn't had its act together as it's been dealing with all this lately. But to the extent that the probability of a Clinton win gets stronger, I think it provides much clarity for the Australian government. I think the people you work for here in this building have much more clarity about who their opposite numbers will be, particularly in foreign affairs, in defence, in trade, in a whole bunch of ways that our governments interact. The set of characters likely to come into the State Department, for instance, under a Clinton administration, Australia is very much in the frame for them. Asia will be, I think, a bigger priority for a Secretary Clinton, for a President Clinton, than it was for Obama. And like I said, I tend to think the names you hear being talked about as likely people to be in the Asia staff are well known to us in Australia, and greatly valued Australia's relationship with the United States. No one knew what those sentences went, how if Trump were to become the... No one had any great clue about the sort of foreign policy team he would put together. So I take some reassurance from that as well. But I'll stop at that point and take some questions. Sure.
Just some people will probably have to run off. Mm-hmm. Just a quick question to lead. What's the betting that's always an interesting counterpoint to
So the betting the right now, the betting markets don't wait for the polls. So literally in real time, as it was Friday in the United States when that videotape dropped, the betting markets moved literally in real time, and they're out to about in the mid-80s. They sort of they're pretty close to those poll averages. When you convert the prices to the underlying implied probability, so Trump certainly eased right out and Clinton has firmed right up, that roughly track the betting. The seat-by-seat markets, I find, and the national isn't, right, as we know, it's the Electoral College that decides the matter, and hence there's like five states that decide the matter, but they all moved as well. Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, all of them kind of must-win states for Trump, slid towards Clinton.
Start here and then Bill.
I wonder whether you'd venture a view on the down the ticket, seeing as
Ryan
has basically said, I'm going to just concentrate on down the ticket.
And I think actually I went long enough, but I was thinking of putting in some material on that. But that's much harder to predict, number one. But number two, the predictions that are out there are just, with this batch of polls that we're starting to process post-videotape, you know what I'm referring to, put the Senate, just have tipped it back. The probability that the Senate is in Democratic hands is now 54%, but I wouldn't, right? And the number being close to 50, I think, reflects the uncertainty there, right? It's not much better than a coin flip, right? Barely better than a coin flip. But to the extent Clinton does well and Republicans are demoralized and stay at home, right, and that's what Save the Furniture is about. Yes, we know he's despicable, but there are these senators and governors, and it's important to also remind people why that's so important in the American system. The Senate is where Supreme Court nominations get voted on, and also treaties. Go through the US Senate as well. So it's an important body, and a lot of other appointments beside are subject to not just the Supreme Court but other judicial appointments. And that Republicans care a lot about that because that's where guns, same-sex marriage, abortion, a lot of that is out in court land, right? Not so it's a really key thing to be focused on and why Save the Furniture is so important to them.
Question, Bill and
then...
Is there a possibility that the Democrats could win Congress?
Yes, but it's still pretty remote. And part of the answer is, look, if it's a monster blowout, yeah, right? But Republicans have engineered a little bit of advantage there through some of it's kind of quote-unquote natural through the way that... the Democratic vote tends to, well, some of it's the states, right? Wyoming, there's some malapportionment built into the American system, both in the Senate and in the House, but moreover, gerrymandering is a mechanism whereby Republicans, and we saw this particularly in state legislative contexts, you'd see in 8 and 12, Obama, on the back of high minority turnout, would win a state like, I'm going to pick one, Wisconsin. Wisconsin would go for Obama 52-48, 53-47, say. But in the state legislature, the Republicans would get, right, 47% of the vote, but still be able to put together 52-53% of the seats. Right? And it wasn't just Wisconsin. It was Florida. It was a whole bunch of states besides. And a similar message applies to Congress as well. So gerrymandering, and that's why Republicans care so much. Control of the state legislatures. They control redistricting, not only just for state elections, but also for Congress, right? Unlike Australia, electoral redistributions in the United States are, in some, many states, partisan, controlled by the state legislature themselves, right? So try that one on. The Queensland Parliament draws the boundaries for Queensland's House of Representatives.
They used to.
Right. Or the New South Wales Parliament handles the redistribution of New South Wales, right? And so that's how it looks in the United States. So control of those state parliaments or state legislatures in the United States is so important for that reason. And that's why Republicans, it's been a multi-step process for Republicans, and that's why they're so terrified of this guy bringing the whole house of cards down. They lose control of those state legislatures, it just starts to unravel, because the Democrats will come back in and gerrymander themselves. So, yeah.
So from what I understand, John Kasich, the only state he carried was his own state of Ohio in the primaries. John Kasich,
yeah.
He carried Ohio, and that was the only state I think he carried in the primaries. And he's refused to endorse Trump.
Yes.
Do you think that's going to have an impact in terms of turning Ohio blue?
Yeah, a little. But it gets drowned out so much by the the national campaigns. Ohio, you want to own shares in an Ohio television station. Literally, you cannot buy airtime. It's all bought out months in advance. And Clinton has outbought Trump by 2.5 to 1 in terms of ad time there. And Kasich is, but he's a bit of a maverick. He just came out, by the way, saying, TPP would be a good thing, by the way. We'll see what that does. But yeah, the fact that it's not just Kasich, but other Republicans in the state are distancing themselves from Trump, just none of that helps.
We probably have time for one more question. Back, Luke.
Thanks for the presentation. It's really interesting. Just thinking about the sorts of people who were supporting Sanders, and to the extent that there's some overlap, maybe issues if not voters, with some of the support for Trump, where does that vote, you can contest that's fine. Where does that sort of vote go after this election?
Okay. After this election?
Let's say we've called the election today. What happens to that sentiment or those feelings during the Clinton presidency going into the future?
It's a great question. Sanders and Trump, but Sanders reveals tremendous disenchantment in the Democratic base. In the same way that Obama tapped into, right? Obama, this is what change looks like, and she's the status quo. It was the same message from Sanders. And the idea that this Pete Seeger type Vermont hippie socialist would almost win right, just reveals a couple of things. Hillary is sort of not especially liked, but B, there is real pent-up frustration on the left of American politics, and Sanders became the champion of that. Some of the things did dovetail with, or match up to some extent, with some of the things Trump was talking about, particularly on free trade. But that's about the extent of it. And I think what's happened, the implication for this election is that those Sanders people, as much as they loathe Hillary, Trump is just another, you know, I don't think there was a big misogynist vote for Sanders, you know what I mean? Like I think, yes, there are many, there's maybe one issue you can find they had a sort of a point of agreement, perhaps, with some of the Trump people. Disaffection about globalization, role of Wall Street, which is great coming from Donald Trump, by the way. But he does the extent of it, and they will vote for Hillary to stop this monster. Right? And indeed, Clinton's out there. I'm the last thing standing between you and the conference. I mean, that's one of the taglines at the moment out there on the internet. And so they will turn out for her, I suspect. The caveat there is that they are young, and young people are notoriously unreliable. In many ways, but in the American system, people move, went back to college, and where I was living in July isn't where I'm living in November, and now I'm on the roll, and it's the American system, so there's no automatic following, and it's just blah. So you can lose that vote pretty easily. But the extent they are motivated to vote, it'll be for Hillary. There's a similar phenomenon on the right, by the way, and you see it. It gets played out in real time. Oh my God, I can't possibly vote for Clinton. I can't possibly vote for Trump. What am I going to do? You know, Republicans sort of openly talking about this terrible choice, this conundrum they've got. There's plenty of that going on as well. So going forward, though, I think, look, this is the big question. Are the forces that Trump has on... I presume he's going to lose. I may be wrong, but I'm pretty confident that he's going to lose. But I think the more interesting question is, what does the next Congress look like? And more generally in the culture, is the genie out of the bottle? It is now safe to be a racist in American public life. It is safe. The liberal internationalist consensus just got a huge body blow. Right? NAFTA was passed when centrist Democrats and centrist Republicans voted together in the US Senate. John McCain voted with Joe Biden. And the extremes of their parties voted no. You had radical conservatives voting with the big lefties in the Democratic caucus against it. It was an inside coalition, bipartisan. Is that done? And if that is done, how does America, where's the political will and the champions in the Congress for internationalism, for an assertive America on everything from free trade to military alliances, traditional, you know, projection of soft power, all those sorts of things. And I think no one quite knows the answer to that, but I think it much will depend on who wins and who loses. Now, if Hillary wins big, I think she has a whole bunch of political capital to say, we're going to reassert, right? The grown-ups are back in control. America is the world's preeminent nation. The world is a safer place when America is taking a leadership role. Times are changing, we face challenges, but the idea we retreat from the world is just not viable. She does it if it's a narrow win, and I think she's looking back at the Sanders phenomenon and going, I've got to tread carefully here. But much will depend on the magnitude of her win. And that's, I think, one of the more interesting things about Trump blowing up so amazingly is that does Hillary not only win, but win big, with implications for the composition of the Senate, the composition of the House, and the stock of political capital she has to engage in kind of going back to the center, and the implications that will in turn have for the conduct of foreign policy and trade policy and engagement with America's allies and enemies. We'll see. But I wasn't thinking that way until literally a week and a half ago. But there could be a really big win here where the mandate work starts to be bandied about.
On that note, we should probably wind up. I think you probably share my thinking that was a really interesting sort of dissection of some of the driving dynamics in the US system, and it's so interesting to see how those dynamics vary from our own domestic politics. Please join me in thanking
I'm